Oregon's former top law enforcement official who played a key role in developing the sentencing guidelines, and now as the president of one of the key educational institutions in our state. He will talk about from that perspective as well on trying to get the right balance and best bang for our public safety dollar. And then we also have with us, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Edward Letessa, who's one of the premier experts on what works in and what doesn't in correctional programming. You know, you hear the phrase a lot that treatment works, and you might be surprised that I would take exception to that statement, because some treatment works and some treatment doesn't work, and some treatment works better than others. Some treatment works better with the proper dosage, and Dr. Letessa will be here to help us clarify what's really becoming a growing body of evidence. We, particularly over the last 10 or 15 years, we've become able to see that there are things that do work to reduce recidivism, not in the sense that you can cure people 100%, but that you can take recidivism from, say, 50% over a certain number of years down to 40 and make a statistically significant difference. So I'm very pleased that he will be here with us. I want to introduce Mr. Frommeyer. Mr. Frommeyer was appointed president of the University of Oregon, the state's Association of American University's flagship institution, on July 1st, 1994. He formerly served as Dean of the University of Oregon School of Law, as Oregon's Attorney General, as a member of the Oregon House of Representatives, and as a law professor and legal counsel to the President of the University of Oregon. As Attorney General, he argued and won 6 of 7 cases before the United States Supreme Court, the most cases and best record of any contemporary state Attorney General. And as I mentioned previously, he also was key to developing the state sentencing guidelines, which are now in use today. Colleagues, please welcome Mr. Frommeyer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Frommeyer. I am president of the University of Oregon, but I do speak today not in an official capacity for higher education, but rather as an Oregon citizen with the background, Mr. Chairman, that you have represented. The views, therefore, I express are my own and not those of the state system of higher education. By way of background, you've emphasized that I did serve this state for 11 years as Attorney General. During that time, I chaired the Governor's Commission on Violent Crime, the Governor's Commission on Organized Crime, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I defended the Corrections Division of the State of Oregon in many tribunals, including the United States Supreme Court. I have great respect for the difficulty of managing a correction system. I have great respect for those who, in fact, run that system. And I think I know something of the dilemmas that each of you face as appropriators, as state officials, in trying to make decisions that are in some significant way constrained also by past initiative measures, by other decisions that have been made long before us, and by some continuing knowledge of things that I guess I had to learn the long way. One of them is that in any system of mandatory sentencing, the consequences that are faced by that system and the costs of that system extend over a long period of time and incrementally aren't experienced immediately. So that one has to be acutely aware as a policymaker of the long-term consequences of decisions that may have been made, because they will have an increasingly expensive price tag, but perhaps no obvious impact in terms of the social and human environment that they're trying to impact. That having been said, let me identify what I believe to be a growing crisis, and we overuse that term, so I use it carefully, but a growing crisis in Oregon and nationally concerning the intersection of our correction system and other public priorities. We're seeing, I think, indisputably, an increase in spending on corrections, a declining or flat spending on education, federal assistance that may have helped us in the past in corrections matters that will not continue at its pace, in fact may not continue at all, and a disproportionate effect of all of this on members of America's and Oregon's minority populations. These are intersecting crises, which suggest that we have to look very carefully at our public priorities, because our priorities aren't always what we say they are. They are what we do. They are the collective impact of decisions that we make. And good intentions may carry us part of the way, but if the actual consequences of our decisions magnified over time takes us in another direction, it does suggest to me that it's time to take a hard, careful look at our responsibilities. So let me refer first, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and I think you can follow the notes both in your handouts and on the screen in front of you, on where we stand in higher education. I'll consider just the institution that I know. That's the University of Oregon. And I've given to you a graph not of the elevations of the Cascade Mountains, but of the declining public support, and dramatically declining over a short period of time, for the University of Oregon. I think you can tell that that decline between 1990 and 94 is directly the impact of the enactment of Measure 5, because that not only required a cutting of state budgets, it required a reprogramming of state dollars into K through 12 education. But it came at the same time as mandatory sentencing laws also had their impact on the requirements for increased public expenditures for the corrections system. In this period of time represented by this graph, the Department of Corrections budget has tripled. It's tripled in the last dozen years. In real dollars, the University of Oregon gets less from the state today than it did in 1999. So corrections mandates, ballot measures, a repayment of COPs, and otherwise, require higher fund, and higher education has, if I may say so, become the ATM of the state's budget. The place where it may have seemed to policymakers that expenditures were the most expendable, and where reprogramming of funds could be done with somewhat of the assurance that the backs of the students could bear it. Tuition increased immediately following Measure 5 more than 80% at the state system of higher education. And so because there seemed to be this inexhaustible assumption that cutbacks in general funds could be substituted for by increased tuition dollars, we see the situation that's arrived today. But looking at the next graph, and bearing in mind that the last one you saw was falling from left to right, here's one that's increasing from left to right, and that's our enrollment. Our enrollment is increased during the same period of time, but there are roughly 2,000 students over this last biennium for which we estimate that there was no state support. Said another way, they were being educated on their tuition dollars alone. And in this brief story, you find, I think, a fairly obvious truth, which is you can't balance your budget by increasing volume when you lose money with every additional student. Let me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just identify for you figures that are probably familiar and gross, but which take on a stark reality when we see them comparatively. Because the institutions you're looking at now are the flagship public institutions, fellow members of the Association of American Universities, the association with which the university is proud to be associated. There are 62 members, half public, half private. So I've selected various of the publics to look at in terms of expenditures per student by the state for the education of students in those systems. And even though you'll see in almost every case, North Carolina, the single exception, North Carolina, a state where the governor and the state legislature have been firmly adhering to higher education, you'll see a drop in the state expenditure per student. But it is no distinction to find that the state of Oregon is at the very bottom, that the amount of state funding per student, and by the way, that does include out-of-state students who receive no state funding. So understand that if that figure were adjusted, as I will in a moment, it would be slightly higher. But you still see not only a drop, but Oregon is dramatically the lowest. Let's take another set of figures, and I know that you are probably familiar with these, but they show the stark contrast in the human investments that we are making. And again, let's distinguish intentions from impact. In the last fiscal year for which we have data, 2005, we received roughly $4,500 per in-state Oregon resident student. In that same period of time, you spent appropriated about $6,492, roughly $2,500 more per student for K through 12. In 2005, that same year, the cost per inmate per day was $67 or $24,648 a year. Said another way, and I know that crude comparisons can sometimes be misleading, but it's nonetheless stark, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We as a state spent public money at the rate of five times per inmate more than we spent per our college students, and four times, roughly, more than we spend for our students in the K-12 system per year. Now, I will say that this, of course, is not unique to Oregon. Our state spending on higher education has declined as prison expenditures have increased. I've distributed to the committee for its own review a 2002 study, so that study is now 5 years old, by the Nonpartisan Justice Policy Institute. Between 1985 and the year 2000, that report shows that state correction spending grew at six times the rate of higher education. And that in 1995, for the first time, states spent more money building prisons than they did building colleges and universities. That year, there was nearly a dollar-for-dollar trade-off between corrections increases and higher education decreases. In addition to these matters, not only are the costs going up in terms of the larger share of state spending or the share being reduced, but college costs have risen, and the burden of those costs, as I've identified earlier, has been borne by the students. You'll see that the increase, the cost for low-income families, has increased from 13% of their income to about 25% of their income in the year 2000. The average Pell Grant, which is the largest federal assistance grant system, as you know, covered 98% of tuition in 1986. It only covered a little bit more than half by the year 1998. What other impacts are there? Let me identify one of them as access for minority students. And the full title of the Justice Policy Institute study makes my last point. It is Cell Box or Classrooms, the Funding of Higher Education and Corrections and Its Impact on African American Men. Our nation's increasing emphasis on incarceration has had a significant and disproportionate effect on non-whites, especially African Americans and Latinos. There's much data in this report which speaks to our problem nationwide. That data is not broken out for the state of Oregon, I hasten to add. Those are numbers that you will have to find elsewhere. We do strive to increase diversity and access and opportunity on our campuses. There are significant financial and aspirational roadblocks for access, particularly for minority students. That's a problem that we face that's going the wrong direction. I'd now like to ask you to turn your attention to the economic impact brochure, because among the other things that we need to ask ourselves, again, if you're looking at actions and impacts rather than just intentions, is what is it for which we expend our money? Prisons are an expenditure. I would argue, and I hope I can make that argument both convincingly and quickly, is that education is an investment. Prisons are expenditure, education is an investment. And again, I've broken out this data just for one educational institution. Oregon State's might even be a larger impact because of the nature and kind of the federal research that it does. But the direct and indirect impact of expenditures at just one of our seven institutions of the state of Oregon, the University of Oregon, was $1.2 billion last year. And that's conservatively calculated by professional economists using conservative multipliers. Or said another way, since our overall state appropriation was just only slightly more than $60 million of general fund money, there's a 20-to-1 positive impact for the investment of state tax dollars in the University of Oregon in terms of its overall impact on the state's economy. Most of the money we receive comes from outside the state, out-of-state tuition, federal grants, and federal research money. Most of the spending is done in the state. So there's a positive balance of payments included in addition to this 20-to-1 impact. Even in addition to that, I may hasten to add that the employees of the University of Oregon paid $12 million of the $60 million of income tax support that they received. If you look at the impact beyond the overall spending, look at what research and technology have been doing. Federal research has increased to $96 million, up about 67% just in a five-year period of time. More than 60 companies have been created by the inventions of faculty, and sometimes assisted by students, that have come directly. Last year, the inventions and the royalties from them created by University of Oregon faculty brought $4.3 million to our bottom line. We help to run our university on the basis of inventions that we find. That's software patents, that's hard patents, that's company licensing revenues. Per research dollar, it's one of the top research universities in the country, exceeding even some of the very well-known names in America. And I use per capita figures because, of course, we're much smaller than most of the public institutions of this country. So all of these bring the knowledge economy to the state of Oregon. All of them bring renown to the state of Oregon. All of them add to the general comfort and welfare of the people of the state. The same is true of out-of-state tuition dollars. Millions of dollars come to the state of Oregon from out-of-state students. They receive no general fund support from the state legislature. They pay more than three times the in-state tuition of our resident students, and they actually provide more for the University of Oregon budget than does the state of Oregon right now. International students alone paid $15 million to come to our university, and they're attracted because it's a quality place, because it's a great environment, and because it has an attitude that cares for our students. And it adds concretely and tangibly to the quality of life that we share together. How do you value a university education? There are many ways to do it. Some of them may seem quite crude, but they're pretty direct. The average college graduate, we're told, in most cases now will earn about $1 million more over a lifetime than a person who has only a high school degree. That doesn't say a college student is a morally better person. It just is raw testimony to the fact that educational attainment increasingly defines the gap between those who are struggling to be in the American middle class, those who get nickeled and dimed, and those who have the opportunity for individual liberation and to provide for their families because they have the level of education that that allows them to survive in a world that's increasingly defined by being part of the knowledge economy. Our graduating class of 2005 is going to generate nearly $280 million in income tax revenue over their respective careers. And I think, as you know, there's about $4.67 in tax revenue for every dollar the state invests in one of our students. I, of course, want to talk about education not just in terms of the dollar return. Hopefully it has something to do with civic literacy. Hopefully it has something to do with making even better decisions as we vote as individuals for those who represent us. Hopefully it creates people who are empowered themselves to seek office or to undertake working for their communities. Hopefully it will bring authors of books, people who give attention to civic activities. All of these are benefits that go far beyond those that are measured in raw economic dollars. But they are, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, investments. And if one looks at our priorities again by impact rather than intention, I hope that my message to you, or at least the perspective I brought to you, helps to clarify the judgments that you will be making in the course of your allocations. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frommeyer. I think your point that priorities aren't always what we say, but how we act is a very important and relevant point as we move through this budget process. I'd like to open it up for questions. Representative Nickinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't mind, I would like to ask Mr. Frommeyer to repeat or expand just a bit on something that you talked about in your opening remarks. Now that we've heard about the value of education and the costs and the state investment in education, could you please reiterate for us again in your opening remarks what you mentioned about the consequences of policy decisions that have been made and the long-term costs that accrue in the public safety part of the budget?
Yeah. I will. I'd be happy to do that, Representative Nathan, Mr. Chairman. And maybe I can do so by making two points that I think are indisputable. One is that the cost of prisons doesn't really lie long-term in the cost of construction, massive though that is. I mean, it's in the $1 billion range in recent years, as members of this committee well know. It is in the length of the incarceration beyond that that would otherwise have been expected for particular classes of offenders. So that the cost is incurred in terms of building the hardware and the bunks will not be the sustaining cost that really swallows up the state's budget. That comes with the length of the incarceration over and above what ordinarily would have been expected in, say, a sentencing guidelines system. And that cost is incurred in future years. It isn't even incurred now. It isn't even incurred at the time of the enactment of increased sentences. It is incurred only when the increased portion of the sentence begins to be served by numbers of inmates. That's so it's not a front-end loaded expense, it's a tail expense, and the tail is much longer, and it may not even be in the lifetime of those persons who are either voters or appropriators at the time that that it actually begins to be incurred. So that is a particular point. It's not in construction, it is in the longer term of the sentence.
Other questions? Senator Nelson, then Senator Westland.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Your chart with the declining state support is very similar to a chart that I see someplace else, and I don't want to be inconsistent with anything. I'm trying to find a solution here. How do we increase our funding for state services? That chart is very similar to the decline in our federal timber forest harvest. Is there anybody in your university that could either validate what I'm saying or shut me up forever?
Well, Mr. Senator Nelson, I would not attribute the declines or the increases in the charts that I presented to you to the decline in timber harvest. There may well be an association of the two, but the disruptive events from the standpoint of the state's budget, in my view, and I'm happy again to say this is a personal view as a longtime observer and participant in government rather than as a president, it can be identified really in terms of watershed events. Number one is the passage of Measure 5 in 1990, which caused not only an enormous shift to the state's general fund from activities that were previously funded at the local level, but also caused a reallocation once shifted. And as you recall, we were given 3 biennia to readjust the general fund payment. In that period of time, it traceable in significant part to the passage of Measure 5, the appropriations of higher education to the state's, from the state's general fund fell from 12% of that fund to about 7% of that fund. So they fell nearly in half. You'll find that at that time, correction spending, because of the passage of another mandatory initiative, Measure 11, correction spending went approximately to where now it is approaching the 12% that higher education used to occupy. So some of this is voter-induced. That is to say, it's mandated expenditure based upon the public's view passing a particular initiative of what it wanted to accomplish. But its long-term consequence was a reallocation in major way of the shares of K through 12 education and corrections in the state general fund budget. I've already mentioned the second shock to the system, which came with the passage of Measure 11, which required the construction in a significant degree, the expenditure of immediate capital construction dollars for prisons on a very significant scale. And of course, the third of the cushions up and down of the timber industry in the general economy, but through the 90s, those problems were cushioned by a booming economy that shifted to a high technology economy in Oregon at the same time that the spotted owl crisis meant that our rural communities were severely impacted. But those impacts were masked by the increase of population in the metropolitan area due to something like $13 billion worth of investment in high technology, chip plants, and so forth. And most of the what otherwise would have been experienced as really severe shocks to our fiscal system in Oregon, unbalanced as I believe it is personally, were also cushioned by something else, which is, of course, the Oregon State Lottery and the legalization or semi-legalization of video poker, which now has become a dependency from which we cannot be weaned, and which probably couldn't have been foreseen in 1990 when the passage of Measure 5 or Measure 11 as being something that basically would disguise the secular shift in how we allocate money and where we find it.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple comments, if I may. The first is just to discuss what I think is President Frommeyer's main point. And I had this conversation with Dave, as well as then Representative and now Director Max Williams, numerous times. And it's really this tension and chaos created by this intersection of representative democracy and direct democracy. I mean, let's just say it the way it is. And it's not just, as President Frommeyer has indicated, 5 and 11. I mean, during the 90s, greatest economy in the history of the planet, with a revenue structure that's too responsive, Oregon's general fund revenue doubled. It grew 100%. It grew from $5 billion to $10 billion. Of that $5 billion growth, the citizens, through the initiative process, either ballot measure, the tax cuts, 5 and 47/50, or the unfunded spending mandates, 11, 44, 66, and 99, we spent $4.3 billion of that $5 billion growth. And then, because of the volatility of our revenue structure, the most volatile in America, we entered the worst recession in this state's history. And then you couple that with these diminishing numbers that President Frommeyer put on the screen, and what it doesn't talk about is the increasing impacts of what I am going to make a guess is the single fastest growing line item in your and most every other budget in the state, and that's health care costs. Same in DOC. It's just, you know, any budget you want to talk to. You want to talk to the big business down the street or the small business down the street? You want to talk University of Oregon or State of Oregon? That's the single fastest growing line item in most budgets. So in some regards, my real comment here, after trying to put these winds that have been buffeting the small ship of state, and in this case the ship of University of Oregon, you know, for decades, is that I just want to thank from the bottom of my heart your service, your public service, as is exhibited by your presence here today, and continuing to try and improve this place we all love so much. Dave, thank you very, very much.
One quick question, and then we've got to let Dr. Latessa come forward. He's got to get back to Portland.
I just thank you again for coming. I really appreciate it. I think that's a signal, Mr. Chair.
Your state senate at work.
I can't get it.
Very well done, Senator Brown. I just wanted to get your thoughts. We had Measure 11 in 1994 that launched a prison boom of which we've never seen the likes. And we've got another prospect of another mandatory sentencing boom. You know, as a person who's in higher education, I think you called yourself the expendable one. I mean, how do you look at that, something like that coming down the pike? I mean, does that make you nervous?
Well, every use of initiative system which involves either a cutback of existing revenues or the requirement to do something for which no revenues are provided is a scary prospect for the people of Oregon in terms of making long-term investments. You, as the Legislative Assembly members, have a constitutional duty for which Oregonians ought to be very grateful, and that is to balance your budget. You can't send something out where the receipts and liabilities don't match. That isn't true of a system in which someone can legislate with a particular majority and say, you must spend this amount of money or you must restrict this degree of revenues, and never have to balance the checkbook. That's something at which in our present system is intrinsically, in my view, it's a personal view but one I've stated publicly, unrepresentative, unrepublican. I think at some level it violates Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, which guarantees us a Republican form of government. And to me, Republican form of government is one in which the ultimate legislative responsibility must exist on both sides of the ledger. Our courts, for various reasons, some of which I understand, some of which I think are unfathomable, will not reach that question. But each of us swears an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. And in my view, this is fundamentally what a Republican government is about. It's about accountability. It's about accountability, including accountability for the fiscal welfare of the state. And if you provide for the expenditure of revenues for a particular subject, you ought to provide the source of those revenues. If you want to cut revenues, you ought to provide for those things which are cut all in one package. That's not the way our present system has been construed to operate. But it is a profoundly difficult thing for us to deal with. And let's put one other thing on the table, if I may, Senator Burdick, and that is no one wants to bear the accusation that he or she is soft on crime or coddles criminals. I didn't, I haven't, I don't today. Probably there's no one I'm facing right now who hasn't been the victim of a property crime in this state of Oregon, and certainly you all have constituents who have. There are ways to deal with those issues that don't involve the abdication of civic responsibility in the legislative process, however. And I think that's the choice we have to face.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Frommeyer. Representative Barker.
Thank you. Mr. Frommeyer, you were Attorney General a couple of decades ago. It's been quite a while.
Yes. Increasingly involved.
Yeah, I thought you did a great job when you were there. But since Measure 11, violent crime has plummeted in Oregon. I know it's very expensive, but I don't know how we put a price compared to a student to the Korean grocer in Portland who got shot in the back of the head, who's paralyzed from the neck down. I mean, those kind of things. And so I think the guy who shot him won't be shooting anybody for many years to come, and I see a savings to society in that respect. And I wish I had some way of balancing out the numbers better. But I want prisons to be safe not only for the guards but the prisoners as well, and so I mean I know these things are very expensive, but this is kind of an odd apples and oranges discussion today, I thought, but thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barker, I appreciate not only your personal experience but also the point you raised generally. And I would just say this, though, that in a system of determinate sentencing, even in a system in which judges have the discretion to impose sentences, certainly any kind of atrocity of the sort that you've described or otherwise would have been dealt with by an extraordinarily long prison sentence in any event. So it's not what's happened at the ballot box, in my view, that has determined whether or not that particular class of offender and that particularly horrendous kind of crime would necessarily be punished more greatly or lesser. I think that that's the kind that would be punished even under a system that pre-existed the sentencing guidelines would be calling for an extraordinarily long sentence if there's a conviction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frommeyer, for coming forward with this important message. We appreciate your service to the state. Colleagues, we're going to move forward with Dr. Latessa's presentation. I'm just going to give a brief introduction to him. I think in following up on Mr. Frommeyer's remarks is particularly relevant because no matter where we come down on the view of, you know, whether or not mandatory sentencing is a good thing, a bad thing, whether or not determinate sentencing is a good thing or a bad thing, the one thing I think we can all agree on is that we should try to keep people from reoffending to the greatest degree possible that we can, and that's why Dr. Latessa is here. Dr. Latessa is a professor and head of the Division of Criminal Justice at the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Latessa has published over 110 works in the area of criminal justice, corrections, and juvenile justice, and he was the co-author of 7 books, including Corrections in the Community and Corrections in America. Professor Latessa has directed over 100 funded research projects, including studies of day reporting centers, juvenile justice programs, drug courts, intensive supervision programs, halfway houses, and drug programs. He and his staff have also assessed over 450 correctional programs throughout the United States. And colleagues, when we have a further hearing on Senate Bill 267, you'll get an additional appreciation of Dr. Latessa's work, because that is the model that both the Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Corrections are now using in ascertaining their own effectiveness. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Edward Latessa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for allowing me to speak in front of the committee today. I'm going to walk through rather briefly kind of the basic research on effective interventions, and you have some handouts, and because of time I may skip a few things, but basically what I want to try to show the committee is what the body of research has taught us over a fairly significant period of time, and more importantly how this research affects not only outcomes and recidivism, but actually can affect behavior within institutions and make them safer places. Try to go through that rather quickly, and then we can be happy to answer any questions that that you have. First, I want everyone to understand that the research, the evidence-based movement, if you will, is really based on empirical research. There are different forms of evidence, beginning with anecdotal evidence, which, as I said here, always makes us feel pretty good, but it doesn't have substance or the generalizability that the empirical research does. Oftentimes the empirical research doesn't make us feel very good, but really what we're talking about are multiple studies over long periods of times in many different jurisdictions, and I'm going to show a few of those along the way, but that's really what the whole evidence-based movement is based on. Most of this research, when we look at the effects on recidivism, and let me be clear, there are many, many aspects to correctional sanctionings that's important, including punishment and deterrence and restoration. But when we look at specifically recidivism, we do not see, that research does not show consistent evidence that punishment alone has an effect on reducing recidivism. This is not to say that some people shouldn't be punished. It's not to say that we're not going to punish. It's not to say that there aren't some studies that show effect. But when we look at that body of research, we do not see evidence that sanctions alone have appreciable effect. On the other hand, studies of correctional treatment show effects on recidivism. As this says, 40% to 60% of studies. The problem with that, of course, is that means that 40% to 60% of studies don't show effects. And that's really what I want to try to talk about, is what the difference is between those programs that have an effect and those programs that don't. When we look at this data in its totality, and this is results from what we call a meta-analysis, we see that there are very modest effects from treatment. This is a fairly modest effect size. Sanctions alone produce slightly negative. Some studies show effects of zero. Some effects show negative one or two. So it varies, but there are, as I said, no general studies that show positive effects. And unfortunately, these are the people that appear to be most resistant to punishment. These, of course, make up the majority of offender populations, risk takers and folks that abuse substances and people that have been punished before. And so punishment alone doesn't seem to have much effect, primarily because it's lost its effect, if it had any at all to begin with this population. Researchers like myself and many others who have studied correctional interventions have concluded that without some form of human intervention, we're unlikely to see much effect on recidivism. Again, it's not always our goal to reduce recidivism, but if that's something we want to achieve, then we have to turn our attention to the intervention and the treatment side. But as I say in this slide, not all treatment is equally effective. This slide is one that I use to show the difference in basic types of treatment. The effect sizes for non-behavioral treatment is very minimal. Unfortunately, many of the correctional programs that operate in the United States fall into the non-behavioral category. It would include things like drug education, programs that rely on talk therapy, almost any type of educational-based program. What we see are very minimal effects. Behavioral programs show much stronger effects, and it's an important distinction because behavioral type of programs focus on current risk factors. They attempt to reduce those risk factors that are influencing somebody's behavior, and these type of programs are very action-oriented. They attempt to teach people new skills and new ways to behave and to replace the skills that they've already acquired, most of which are antisocial. So what we try to do is to advocate for the development of behavioral programs whenever possible. This chart is a summary of what we call major risk factors correlated with criminal conduct. And it's a very important lesson because what we find is that many correctional programs, although well-intentioned, oftentimes are targeting areas that have very little to do with criminal behavior. Or they're targeting areas that will produce very small effect sizes. This chart shows what we call the big four: a history of antisocial behavior, antisocial personality, antisocial cognitions, and antisocial associates. In the next chart, I show the remainder of the major risk factors: family, marital, school and work, leisure and recreation, and substance abuse. But it's very important for folks to understand that most researchers that study risk factors believe that this set of risk factors, along with other minor risk factors, all run through the big four. It's really the big four that are driving most criminal behavior. And as an example of that, I want to show the results from a recent study done in Pennsylvania by the Department of Corrections looking at parole revocators. And this is a particularly important topic since we know from many studies that a large part of our prison population is being driven by people who are returning to prison for violations. They're released into the community and they're unsuccessful. Not always as a result of new criminal behavior, but because they can't follow the rules that are set. They're using drugs or drinking, they're not supporting their children and so forth. This study was recently done in Pennsylvania, and these were the three primary areas related to return to prison: unrealistic expectations about life outside of prison. These offenders maintained antisocial attitudes, values, and beliefs, and had inadequate coping and problem-solving skills. That's the second part of this study, which they just completed. Pennsylvania broke out in some detail what those factors were related to, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but what I'm really trying to show is how strongly you see the big four run through these factors. And it also dispels, I think, some myths we have about reintegration. What they found, of course, that the offenders that come out of prison that are unsuccessful are more likely to continue to hang around with people that have criminal backgrounds. They're not in stable relationships. They don't have someone in their life that serves as a mentor, someone they can go to for good advice. In terms of employment and financial situations, and this is an important area because we focus a lot of attention on employment, and what they found is that they were only slightly more likely in having difficulty getting a job. They were less likely to have job stability. They were less likely to be satisfied with employment. I think more importantly, they were less likely to take low-end jobs and work their way up. They had negative attitudes about employment. They were less likely to save money, and they were more likely to report they were barely making it, despite the fact that successful groups had over double the median death. And so much of what revolved around employment was, in fact, cognitive, their attitudes and their values and their beliefs about employment. And I think it's an important point because we often associate it with risk, and obviously there's a relationship. But if most of us lost our job, we wouldn't become criminals. We'd go get another job. And many offenders, of course, fall into, we work at employment when in fact we have to work on those attitudes and values that many of them possess. In terms of alcohol and drug use, another area that we spend an inordinate amount of resources targeting, what we found was that they were more likely to report the use of alcohol and drugs on parole, but there really was no difference in their dependency level prior to that. And that poor management of stress was a contributing factor to relapse. So they couldn't handle the day-to-day stress and emotional situations they found themselves in. Again, here we see they had a lack of coping skills, they failed to utilize resources, and they were more likely to maintain their antisocial attitudes. Interestingly, there was no difference in their difficulty in finding a place to live, and successes and failures were equally likely to report eventually finding a job. And so this study, this Pennsylvania study, I think helps confirm what us researchers have been saying a long time about the risk factors and why they're important. All this research has led to a set of principles, and they're articulated in different ways in the literature, but I've tried to simplify them so that everyone can understand what they translate into in terms of risk, need, treatment, and fidelity. And I want to talk a little bit about risk in particular because I think it's pertinent to the discussion you've been having. The risk principle basically says target offenders with a higher probability of recidivism. And that's important because I think there's a distinction between the seriousness of the crime and the risk of the offender. There are two things we often consider in sentencing: the propensity to continue the behavior, the risk, and the seriousness of the crime that you've committed. Some people go to prison not because they pose a significant risk for continued behavior, but because they've committed a serious crime and they need to be punished. Others go to prison because they have a pattern of this antisocial behavior over a period of time, and so we incarcerate those folks, even though the presenting offense may not have been particularly serious. This research basically says we really want to focus on those individuals that have the highest probability of continuing that behavior. A simple way to think about it is if half of the offenders that come out of the youth authority in Oregon, or half the offenders that come out of prison, don't return, which half are we worried about? Well, we're worried about the ones that will. And that's really a simple way to understand the risk principle. Those are the individuals we want to put resources into. We want to provide them the most intensive treatment. And unfortunately, this last finding is one, I think, that often poses the most problem with an understanding, is that intensive treatment and interventions for lower risk offenders can in fact increase recidivism. We can actually make them worse by putting them not only incarceration. There's a slightly negative effect from that, research indicates. But oftentimes when we put offenders into intensive programs and treatment, we often increase their chances of continuing the behavior. This is, again, a result from meta-analysis, where we see the strongest effects are on higher risk offenders. This is a recent study we completed in Ohio, where we tracked 14,000 youth that had been served in the state. We have youth that were in the community, youth that were placed into residential programs, and youth that were placed in institutions. What you see is that low-risk youth that were kept in the community had an 8% recidivism rate. But low-risk youth that were put into residential programs had 2.5 times the recidivism rate. So placing low-risk youth in out-of-home placement was not a good decision. For moderate risk youth, the negative impact was at the institutional level. Half of the youth in Ohio were classified as moderate risk. These youth were sent to state institutions, and we doubled their recidivism rates. We saw no effects, harmful or otherwise, at this end. But interestingly, in Ohio, we found that the very high-risk youth actually performed better in the structured programs. And what's interesting is this number, even though this constituted only 4% of the population in Ohio, that translated into 400 youth. So it was a significant number of very high risk that were placed in the community and did worse. But clearly, we see the harmful effects down at the lower end of this table. I'm not going to go into detail about this study. I'm just going to show the results. But this was a major study that we completed in 2003. At the time, it was the largest study ever done of community correctional residential programs. But I want to point out that half of these offenders were coming out of prison. The other half were probationers in the community who received a residential placement. We were asked by the state to determine the effectiveness of these programs. What we found was low-risk offenders who were placed in those programs performed significantly worse than low-risk offenders who were only given some form of community supervision. I think it's important, that distinction, because we're not saying not to do anything with low-risk offenders, but clearly, these individuals did better when they were given the ability to stay in their communities and stay with their families and stay on their jobs rather than to be placed in these rather expensive correctional programs that we design. Very few programs had an effect for low-risk offenders. When we go down to the treatment effects for high-risk offenders, what we see is a significant change, just the opposite effect. Very few programs. We had a few programs that didn't work for anyone, by the way. These were poorly designed and poorly implemented programs. But what we found in Ohio, which mirrors other studies, is at the high end, we had a number of programs that were reducing recidivism over 20 and in some case over 30% for high-risk offenders. And I want to point out there were over 13,000 offenders in this study. And so if we can design correctional programs that are able to produce 20 and 30% effect sizes, we can have a significant effect on recidivism. Where you really see the risk principle is down here. I'll take this program, which reduced recidivism 32% for high-risk offenders. This program increased recidivism 29% for low-risk offenders. So we know it's not the quality, in this case, of the program. It was the type of offender that they were receiving. So I think it has important implications for the placement of offenders into correctional treatment programs. And by the way, we saw the same effect with both females as well as for sex offenders. Those low-risk sex offenders that were put in these intensive programs actually did worse, and the high-risk sex offenders, we had a significant effect on their recidivism rates. And the reason we believe these effects occur are two reasons. One is, obviously, putting low-risk and high-risk offenders together, the social learning that occurs is often toward the low risk. And, you know, it's not a hard thing to understand. If you had a 14 or 15-year-old son or daughter, you wouldn't want them in with a group of high-risk delinquent kids. And so it's easy to understand that effect. The other reason we believe it occurs is because when you take low-risk people and you put them into these intensive interventions, you're often disrupting what makes them low risk. You're disrupting their family, their jobs, their associations, their relationships. And so if I were to take you all right now and put you in a correctional treatment program for 6 months, my guess is that you'd lose your job and you'd lose your standing in the community, and your neighbors wouldn't have a welcome home from the correctional treatment reception for you when you got out. So we see this is why we think we get these negative effects with lower risk people. The Mead principle basically reiterates what I said in terms of targeting risk factors. Again, this is an important chart because it really indicates that it's not simply targeting a risk factor. In my opinion, a lot of correctional programs fail not because they don't target appropriate risk factors, but because they don't target a sufficient density of risk factors. People are in high risk because they have a risk factor. They're high risk because they have a number of risk factors. Again, you're not high risk because you lose your job. But if you don't work, and you hang around with other people that don't work, and you think not working is okay, and you don't mind someone supporting you, well, now being unemployed increases your risk dramatically because you have a lot of time to do nothing but get into trouble. And so understanding this helps us design better correctional programs because we don't have these unidimensional type of approaches. The treatment principle, as I've said, focuses behavioral interventions, structured social learning programs, cognitive behavioral approaches, and family-based approaches. I should point out that some of these types of interventions have a history in Oregon. Both the University of Oregon and Oregon State have done a lot of work, particularly in the family intervention area. So there's a history of these kind of programs in the state of Oregon. Cognitive approaches, which tend to be the most popular, are designed to focus on the thinking and the attitudes and the values that people have that lead them to making bad choices and making bad decisions. This is the latest meta-analysis on cognitive behavioral treatment. And what they found was, on average, it had a 25% reduction in recidivism, but the most effective configurations found 50% reductions. Things that didn't matter included the type of research design used in the study, the setting. Prison effects were strong as community effects, provided the treatment was done closer to the end of the sentence. Juvenile versus adult. Minorities or females, or the brand name of the program that was being used. But what did matter was dosage of treatment, fidelity of treatment, and the risk and need principle. The higher the risk, the more needs that were met, the better the program was implemented, the stronger the effects. I'm going to skip through this study for time. I want to show this meta-analysis because oftentimes, especially in a prison setting, there are more immediate concerns than recidivism. And those immediate concerns revolve around safety and misconduct among the inmates. And so we're looking to try to design institutions in which our correctional officers can go to work and feel safe. And so this study looked at a meta-analysis involving over 21,000 offenders in 68 studies, looking at different measures of misconduct, including violent, nonviolent, and institutional. It included both male and female, and both adult and juvenile. What they found was the strongest effect size on institutional behavior came from behavioral programs. Other types of programs, non-behavioral, education and vocational, and unspecified, produced minimal effects on institutional conduct. The more criminogenic risk factors that were targeted in the programs, the stronger the effect on misconduct. The higher the quality of the program, the stronger the effects on misconduct. And the good news was misconducts were correlated with recidivism. So getting inmates to behave helped reduce recidivism. What doesn't work with offenders, I got this from my friends in Oklahoma. And it says, Lakota tribal wisdom says, when you discover you're riding a dead horse, the best strategy is to dismount. However, in corrections, we try other strategies, including the following. Buy a stronger whip. Change riders. Say things like, this is the way we have always ridden this horse. Point a committee to study the horse. I hope that's not what we're doing here. Arrange to visit other sites to see how they ride dead horses. Create a training session to increase our riding ability. Harness several dead horses together for increased speed. Declare no horse is too dead to beat. Provide additional funding to increase the horse's performance. Declare the horse is better, faster, and cheaper dead. Study alternative uses for dead horses and then promote the dead horse to supervisory position. These are some things, some interventions and strategies that have not proven to be effective. Focusing on fear and other emotional appeals to reduce drug usage. Shaming offenders. When we take antisocial people and shame them, I can assure you what we get are angry antisocial people. And I don't know of too many of us that like to be shamed and humiliated, and most of us are pro-social. Drug education, non-directive approaches, client-centered approaches, having them tell us what we think they need, having them read books, Freudian approaches, dealing with the past and trying to reconcile that, talking cures, self-help, and vague unstructured programs, as well as punishing smarter programs. Many of the so-called intermediate sanctions that we use, boot camps and electronic monitoring and intensive supervision, what those studies show is that without treatment, we see either no effects or we see increased recidivism rates. And so that risk reduction component becomes a critical aspect. Finally, the fidelity principle, because I think this is one particularly important in Oregon. When I first came here several years ago to testify about legislation to create what was Senate Bill 267, we spent a lot of time talking about fidelity and looking at programs. Since then, I've worked with both the Department of Corrections as well as the Youth Authority here in Oregon to help them look at the programs that they're funding and that they're operating. And I will tell you that I've been very impressed with the progress that's been made in a relatively short time. I work with many systems around the country, and it is not an easy thing to change a culture and a department as large as these kind of agencies. And I think there have been some fairly dramatic shifts. And I think what this legislation has helped do is bring fidelity to programs. It gives these agencies the ability to turn away some of the ineffective approaches that are often brought forward from well-meaning people, the programs for which there's no evidence that they're going to work. And so fidelity is very important. Every major study that we've done has found a strong relationship between program integrity and recidivism. The higher the program integrity, the greater the reduction in recidivism. With residential programs, the difference between those poorly designed and poorly implemented programs and the best programs was almost a 40%, over a 40% swing in recidivism. And more importantly, as you see, poorly designed programs aren't working. They're actually making people worse. We found the same thing with non-residential programs and the same things with juvenile programs. We have two major studies we're undertaking right now, one in the state of Pennsylvania, one in the state of Ohio. They both involve together about 45,000 inmates. And we're looking at over 120 programs that those states have operated and funded over a long period of time. When those studies are complete, we think we're going to have even more information about how to design better programs. And so we're continuing to learn a lot about what goes into effective correctional programs. The lessons that we've learned is that risk is important. That we can't design one-size-fits-all programs. that we can't, we should not be putting low risk offenders into these intensive interventions, that we get a iatrogenic effect, that designing programs to target those major risk factors and not lose sight of the target. And that's difficult because oftentimes, especially in the juvenile area, we're dealing with children that have a lot of needs. And there's a tendency to want to try to meet all of those needs. And that, while that's admirable, it sometimes leads to diminished effects in terms of recidivism. We have to stay focused on the targets. And using behavioral approaches have demonstrated over across a wide range of research in a variety of settings with a variety of outcome measures that we get the strongest effects when we are focusing on criminogenic risk factors and attempting to teach offenders new ways to behave and new skills. Assessment's important. It's the engine that drives good programs. And integrity makes a difference. It makes a big difference. You can use programs that have been shown to work, but if they're poorly designed and poorly implemented, you'll get negative effects. And we've seen that not only in our research, but Washington State's research and others that are really starting to look at evidence-based programs and how to make them, how to get the most out of those kind of interventions. So, want to leave time for questions. Be happy to answer any.
Thank you very much, Dr. Latessa. We've got a fair amount of time for questions, so fire away. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. The curve for prison behavior really took a big jump in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Those risk factors, I mean, it seemed like if we could get ahead of that, then we wouldn't, it would lessen the strain after these folks get into prison. What are those risk factors? What can we do to prevent
the risk factors of the increase in...
Yeah, I mean, why did it take such a big jump in the 70s, and why it just seems to be going higher and higher now?
Yeah.
We seem like we should get out in front of that, and then maybe we wouldn't have so many problems down the line.
Well, the prison population has been driven in large part in the last decade from changes in sentencing structure, not because of the crime rate. The crime rate over that period of time has been at historic lows. We did see large increases in the 70s in the crime rate, and I think there was a response to that. The response was tougher sentences, mandatory minimums, and the kind of policies that Oregon and other states have followed. But since the 90s, we've seen a very significant drop in crime rates across the country. And yet the prison population continues to grow. And so you're not the only ones wrestling with this question, I can assure you that. Most look at the front end. And when we take offenders, and I think the demographics have changed. If you look at, you know, if you go back 30 or 40 years, many of the people who were in prison are people that kind of worked their way into prison. You know, they were, you know, had accumulated criminal history, committed serious crimes, they ended up in prison. But as we went to mandatory minimums, we started to see a change in that curve because people that might not have gone to prison before now were mandated to prison because they had a gun or because they had so much possession of drugs. And all of a sudden, we saw a somewhat different change in the prison population. And we're keeping them longer. I mean, we're spending an inordinate amount of money for the people that pose the least risk. And once you know, everyone at the table knows as you've gotten older, you've changed. I'm willing to bet none of you go out at midnight now. I have daughters that go out at midnight. You know, they're in their 20s. And I go, Dad, we're going out. And of course, they have to wake me up to tell me that because I've been sleeping in a chair for 2 hours by then. But as we get older, we do mature. We do age out of crime. It's one of the few certainties we have. And yet, we put policies in place where we have 60, 50, and 60-year-olds in prison, and the costs go up dramatically as we age. And so, we, you know, we're putting more in, we're keeping them longer, and we wonder why we have this problem. I mean, it's really not, it's hard to figure out. I think that, just listening to the debate about mandatory sentences, I think states have to look at front-end solutions, trying to and keep people out of prison that shouldn't be in prison, or that we can handle in the community. And for those individuals, and I think violence is when we look at public opinion data, when we, you know, it's clear that violence is that dividing line. People want violent offenders locked up. They want them locked up for a long time. And that's not hard to understand. But when we look at our prison populations, that's just one slice. And we have many offenders that don't fit into that category that we can handle differently, or we can get out of prison quicker if we've got the support systems and we've done the kind of work that needs to be done. So I think that's, you know, what Oregon's facing, and I found a discussion about, you know, dollars for education and dollar for prison. We could have the same discussion in my state and many other states, because those are the tough choices that people are making.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions for you. I'll tell you both.
All right.
Wait for your answer. The first one is about the comment about aging out of crime.
Yeah.
But I wonder how that relates to risk factors. And here's what I'm thinking. Now that there are people who have been in prison longer than they would have been in before, let's say they went in their 20s or 30s, I don't know what the ages, they've been in a long time. If they were to come out of prison now in their 50s or 60s, they've been outside of the regular workforce for so long and lacking skills, that seems to be one of the higher risk factors. So does that mean that we have a group of people that we have pushed into a higher risk category that in hindsight it was wrong, but now we've definitely got a problem? The second question is about the drop in crime rate. I'll ask you, I've asked several other people at different times about this. Where I come from, people don't report property crimes anymore because they know they're not being prosecuted. So we're suspicious when we hear statements about there's a drop in the crime rate. So which kinds of crimes are you referring to when you tell us that?
All right, let's deal with the first one. There is some research on length of sentence and effect sizes, because you know there's one theory that as we keep people longer, they become institutionalized and can't make that adjustment. There's actually very little evidence to support that contention. One study that's been done, meta-analysis, that looked at all of the research, found that there was a slightly negative effect once someone had been over 2 years. Slightly negative, but it was not as harmful as we had speculated. So I don't think that letting out, you know, the older inmates coming out, there will be obviously adjustment issues, but I don't think you'll have a crime wave by letting those folks come out of prison if the support systems are there. The second, in terms of crime data, most of the FBI, what's reported to the FBI, indicates that it's actually been almost across the board. So it's not just property crimes that might not be reported, because violent crimes are reported. Now, in the last 2 years, we're seeing an increase in murders. These data have not all been reported yet, because they're always a couple years behind. But in the last 2 years, there has been an increase in murders in a number of major cities. And so that seems to be going up again. But for that probably 10-year period prior to that, across all the index crimes, the major index crimes, which includes murder, rape, armed robbery, theft, we've seen a decline. Some cases significant. Not since the 60s have we had as low a crime rate. Now, criminologists differ as to why. Some attributed to changes in demographics, an older population. Some attributed to more effective policing. Some attributed to more prisons, more prison populations, incarceration. But what's interesting is some of the states that have had some of the highest incarceration rates have not had the greatest reductions in crime rates. So that correlation appears to be spurious.
Dr. Letessa, over the years, I think we've gone away from having pre-sentence investigations frequently in our criminal justice system. I know here in Oregon that's been the case. It seems to me that what you're calling for indirectly is that the prosecutor, the sentencing judge, should have that kind of assessment of risk factors and needs before the sentencing happens. Am I on the right track there?
I would agree with that. I think the reason we've gone away from pre-sentence investigations is if there's a mandatory sentence, then why would I do that kind of a background check? Why would I gather that information? Mm-hmm. I happen to believe that judges usually make pretty good decisions, and I've looked at data. Judicial decisions usually are sound and based on all the information. We've come a long way in the last 10 years in our ability to predict risk and our ability to we've developed many better actuarial tools. If you look at the work that's going on, just in your neighbor to the north, Washington State has done some major work in this area and just came out with a new instrument that they're now using based on, I think, 100,000 inmates. So there's been a lot of work done. But I think that providing as much information at the time of sentencing is important. And even if the judge is going to make a decision to incarcerate, that information can be invaluable to the Department of Corrections in deciding, do we put this inmate into programs? What kind of programs do we put them in? You know, when we're talking about spending a lot of money incarcerating people and add on top of that the treatment that we might provide, when we have clear evidence that some of them don't need treatment, shouldn't be placed in treatment, I think it makes a lot of sense to start to assess as early on in the process as possible. In Ohio, we're right now in the midst of two large studies, both funded by the state. We're assessing about 2,500 adult offenders and 2,500 juveniles, and we're doing it at every level. So we're assessing them at pretrial, at probation, at intake to prison, coming out of prison, and we're doing that for the state to try to develop a much better process for assessment and decision making, because we want to make better decisions, and it's just smart decisions that we want to make.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. You said that some people wouldn't benefit from treatment. Can you give some examples of someone who would go to prison, say, under a mandatory sentence and would not benefit from treatment?
Well, someone that's low risk, has few risk factors, probably doesn't need treatment. In fact, we've seen some harmful effects in other ways. In Ohio, we just finished a study for the Release Authority, and what we found was that many children, youth, were being delayed from release because they weren't able to get into the programs. Yet, as a group, the low-risk kids had about a 10% chance of recidivating. And so we were keeping them longer, spending a lot of money, when in fact, if you were betting, you would bet they would be successful without the program. There's no evidence that programming would have reduced that recidivism rate even lower.
To follow up from what you said before about how institutionalization actually increases the risk of low-risk offenders, are you saying that under mandatory sentences, if someone who's actually low-risk gets caught up in the mandatory sentence, you're actually increasing their chances of recidivating by institutionalizing them?
I don't say taking a low-risk person and incarcerating them, I think it's fair to say, has some negative effect. I'm not sure how much, because it probably depends on how long they're incarcerated. As we said, over 2 years, the effects become slightly more negative. Most studies of short-term, shock parole, shock probation, those kind of policies, have found no effect on low-risk offenders. Because the harmful effect of taking them out of their pro-social networks disrupts what makes them low risk. There's three theories. One is that by putting those people in, you have a deterrent effect. Basically, you're deterring them from future behavior. The other is by incarcerating them, you're exposing them to high-risk people, thus increasing their criminal conduct. And the third is by putting them in prison or jail, even for a short time, you've reduced their opportunities for legitimate avenues. All right. So once you've gone to prison, even if it's for a month, you're an ex-con. That cuts off certain you can't get certain jobs, you can't, you know, there are all kinds of restrictions. So those are the three theories that operate. I just read an article on the way out that looked at, basically asked the question, does putting someone in prison have a negative effect? And they found that first time incarceration for many actually did have a slightly, rather than have the deterrent effect, it actually had a negative effect, which they attributed mainly, by the way, to cutting off legitimate opportunities, not to the harmful effects of association in that case. But they did find slightly negative.
And I think one of the things that I'm getting out of your presentation is that changing the way offenders think as opposed to the type of things around them is critical. Sheriff Dan Nolley said one time that if you had a program for offenders and taught 100 of them how to weld, at the end of the day you'd have 100 criminals who know how to weld, and that they'd probably end up continuing to be criminals even if they might have had some kind of day job as welders. And my experience running a job placement organization was that it didn't seem to matter if I got somebody a good paying job or a bad paying job, they seemed to screw them up at about the same rate. And that's when it came to my attention that you needed some cognitive behavioral work to help them change the way they do business.
And I think it's two elements. And you take employment, if you have someone who's never worked a day in their life and they think works for someone else, and they have no job skills, and you spend all your efforts on the job skills, you're probably not going to get very far. On the other hand, if you just work on their attitudes and you don't give them the job skills, you're not going to be as effective either. And so it's really combining the cognitive with the skills. And employment's a simple one we can understand, but it applies across the board. You know, I get you to understand that you can't hang around with that crowd you've been hanging around with. I get you to cognitively understand that. Yeah, you get in trouble whenever you go with them. The problem is when they come over and want to go out, it's hard to say no. And so even though I've changed your thinking, if I don't give you some skills on how to get out of those situations, on how to resist that peer pressure, I've only done half the job. And so we really trying to marry the two together to get the most effects. And that's where my work is, and hopefully others are paying attention.
Thank you.
Hannah.
You brought up several things. That's the original question I was going to ask. I was going to mention that it's been several years ago I saw a newspaper, I think it was a national newspaper from a prison. The prisoners, actually. Mm-hmm. But now they were talking about where parole boards say you can't hang out with ex-cons. Well, they go out and the old next-door neighbor doesn't want anything to do with them, and the only people that do are their ex-cons, and that was kind of a catch-22 for them. But what I wanted to ask you is, I'm sure you've had, I hope, I shouldn't say I'm sure, that you've dealt with some of the assessment Oregon's doing.
Mm-hmm.
At the intake, is that not a good program? It seems like I haven't seen the whole thing, but in going through there, they have a pretty good assessment,
yes,
like a pre-sentence investigation, so that in Oregon, anyway, they're trying to put people in the correct programs.
Yes. Yeah, and let me say that, especially the adult system here had been much further ahead. When I first came to Oregon, the youth authority did very little assessment, and they've made a major decision in terms of how they assess kids. But I think the point that we're making is the earlier you can assess, the more information you have for making decisions. Once they come to prison, they're going to assess them.
Yeah.
But if we can move some of that back into community corrections and put it in the hand of judges, they can hopefully make better decisions, so that all along the way we're making decisions that are based on public safety and based on good placement of offenders into the right programs. It's not just do they need a program, but it becomes what type of program.
Yeah.
I mean, assessment's a lot more than just saying this guy's likely to fail. It's what do we target? Not everybody's in prison because they have, you know, they have the same risk factors. And so that becomes another reason for assessment.
Thank you. Representative Hennen.
Thank you. I know this is a short course in all the information that and work you've done in this subject area, although as we've heard in this presentation, how does the recidivism rate or the training or not sending somebody to a correctional facility versus training, or as you've described, some of those who may be lower at risk, I mean, all those things talk strictly to the criminal. How does all of that affect victims? And I mean, you talked about criminals aging out.
Mm-hmm.
Do victims age out at the same rate? Do they forget what happened? I mean, we're stuck to the criminal side here, but what about the victim side, and how does this impact that?
Well, I think in the broadest sense, if we can reduce recidivism 10, 15, 20, have a positive impact on recidivism, we have fewer victims. And I think that's a good thing. And the work that I do is around public safety, because I think, you know, there are people, we're going to lock people up. There's no question about that. It becomes, do we want them coming out better than they went in? Do we want to make good decisions about who we lock up and how long we lock them up? And I think, you know, most would say yes. So victims, I think having fewer victims is a good thing. most of this work, especially in the community, will also include trying to deal with victim impact, trying to deal with empathy, trying to I was in Salem a couple of years ago sitting in on a victim impact group, and part of the philosophy behind that is to help these offenders understand that the harm that they did. And it may not just be to the actual victim. It may not be a victim always, but to their families, to the people that care about them. And that was a part of an overall approach to reduce recidivism. But if that's all you do, you won't get very far. You have to also work on those other risk factors. So we're not ignoring that in this. But my work focuses primarily on, you know, reducing the risk of that offender reoffending. But the whole restorative movement, I think, has opened up everyone's eyes to how important it is to involve victims in these decisions.
Any other questions? Dr. Latessa, thank you very much for your time coming all the way down. He's actually got to be in Seattle for a conference and was out this way and was willing to come 4 or 5 hours out of his way. So thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you for having me.
Colleagues, I was very pleased with this presentation. And as always, if you have people you would like to keep in mind for expert testimony, just let me know and we'll consider it. And shortly coming up, we'll have a hearing on OIA and DOC's attempts to, in their efforts to advance evidence-based practice through Senate Bill 267. And if there's nothing else, this meeting is adjourned.